I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden is meeting with House Democrats this morning with a new framework for his social spending package that he believes will unite his party. Progressives and the president have been negotiating with Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema about the price tag, how to pay for it, and what's in and what is out. Biden's much scaled back plan includes an investment in child care, free preschool for youngsters and home care for elders, a climate change policy, and an expansion of health coverage for low-income Americans. What's out is paid family leave and a prescription drug reform plan, among other provisions. We begin with Domenico Montanaro and Rachel Bade about where things stand and the political implications for the Democrats and for President Biden. Rachel Bade is co-author of the Politico Playbook. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times, especially with all this breaking news.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. And Domenico, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I want to make sure our listeners can join us at any point during this hour as we talk about some breaking news. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Domenico, and to you, Rachel, as well, I had a chance to eyeball, you know, what the president, what the White House is offering to the House Democrats. This seems like a really high wire act for the president. Domenico, do you think it's going to work?
Well, I think that the president, we saw him come out of, come out to cameras as he was on Capitol Hill this morning saying that everyone's on board. So, you know, he, you would think, wouldn't say that if he didn't think everyone was on board. So it seems that he's made a lot of calls over the, not just the night, but over the last few weeks and months. He's really, you know, put in a lot of work in trying to get at least something concrete before he heads on this trip, where he's meeting with the G20 leaders of the nation's largest economies, and in particular that Glasgow climate conference, where, you know, the U.S. has a reputation of having put things forward and then walking them back and not really taking the kind of leadership role that Biden has promised by saying America's back.
And to you, Rachel, do we know, I mean, I outlined a couple of things that I looked at this morning. Do we know what everyone, meaning Democrats, are on board about?
Yeah, I mean, I have a little more skeptical take on this. I think that there's still a big problem on the Hill right now. Basically, you know, I was told a few days ago from multiple progressives that when the White House announced a framework, they were going to not only have this deal with these two moderate senators who, you know, obviously want a smaller bill, sort of a more conservative frame, but they were also going to run it by progressives to get their buy-in at the last minute before they unveiled something. And I'm being told from sources this morning that progressives were basically just told this was what the deal was going to be, and people are not happy up there. And so I am skeptical that they do have everyone on board right now. Bernie Sanders came back from a White House meeting last night where he met with President Biden, and he said it was, quote, inconceivable that he would agree to the framework that he had just been pitched. Now, since then, I don't think we've seen many changes in Bernie Sanders' direction. And so I think they still have a lot of work to do and a lot of disagreements on their hands right now. And I think they're still a little ways off from getting this done.
Well, I mentioned that there's no paid family leave, Domenico, in this framework. There's apparently no prescription drug reform plan in the framework. Free community college, that was jettisoned. What is there for progressives in what's left of this plan?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, because it's certainly, those are some big high profile things that, you know, President Biden had campaigned on that don't look like they would be in a final bill at this point. You know, I think the biggest item that everyone keeps pointing to is universal pre-K,
right,
and some child care subsidies, as well as some elder care subsidies. You know, universal pre-K is obviously a big deal. As someone with kids myself, I remember how much money I spent when they were 3 and 4 years old.
Indeed.
for child care, and, you know, making it, you know, free for everyone in the country to have their kids have not only schooling, but a degree of care. And, you know, 0 to 5 education, everyone talks about, you know, falling through the cracks by the time you get to kindergarten leaves millions of kids behind. So that's one huge piece of something. But look, there's a whole lot more money that's in this, you know, in this bill that really don't have that kind of high profile, easy to sell messaging. And I think that that's a big problem for Democrats. If you can't get progressives to really buy into this, we're looking at something very similar to 2009 when, you know, there was really all this argument over the public option in the Affordable Care Act. And I'm just reminded of President Obama and his team being so frustrated with liberals because they weren't able to get what they wanted to get. And they seemed to be kind of frustrated and upset by it. I mean, President Obama wrote about it in his book, A Promised Land, last year. And, you know, his point was that Democrats tend to have this impact on themselves, where they said that there's this long-term demoralization of Democratic voters, what he calls "what's the point of voting if nothing ever changes" syndrome, even when there are things that they should be happy with.
Well, let me pick up on something, and Rachel, go back to you. Progressives, I believe, started at something like $5 or $6 trillion. Looks like we're down to something like $1.7, maybe $1.8 trillion. So it seems as if, you know, the Bernie Sanders, the Ilhan Omars, and other progressives have given a lot in order to get Sinema and Manchin on board. What's the feeling among progressives?
Absolutely. It's a lot of frustration. And I think the problem that the White House has right now is they did sort of overpromise to this group of progressives. I think had they started the year and said, look, you know, we're going to pass a pandemic relief bill at $2 trillion, we're going to pass an infrastructure bill at $1 trillion, and we're probably only going to get about $1 trillion worth of, you know, social spending as opposed to $6 trillion. I think maybe expectations would have been set a little bit. But a good example of this is what was promised to Bernie Sanders specifically on Medicare. As you know, progressives, especially Bernie Sanders, have been pushing for Medicare for All for a really long time. And when they started doing these negotiations a few months ago, he actually got a promise from Chuck Schumer, the leader in the Senate, that he would get an expansion of his Medicare in this package.
Wow.
Specifically coverage for dental, coverage for vision, and coverage for hearing. And the dental piece is a very expensive bit here, but it would be a huge accomplishment for Bernie Sanders on something that he has worked on his entire life. And so, you know, not only has the total cost of this package come down, but there were promises that were made to progressives over, you know, the various few months of negotiating that are now being taken back. The final package on Medicare does include coverage for hearing, but it doesn't include coverage for dental and vision. And those were two huge priorities for people like Bernie Sanders. And so, because of that, you're seeing a lot of frustration.
Well, let me go back to you, Domenico, and talk about Senators Manchin and Sinema, who clearly have been, you know, calling the shots more than the president himself. What gives them so much power?
Well, there's only 50 votes in the Senate, so it's a pretty clear mathematical thing here. You know, if you've got 50 votes to be able to pass a bill through the reconciliation budgetary process, then you need all 50 senators to be on board without losing a single one. So, you know, there's a big difference here between trying to pass what Biden wanted to call, you know, Great Deal or New Deal measures. You don't have New Deal numbers. You know, Democrats had humongous majorities. They don't even have Affordable Care Act numbers. You know, remember Al Franken made the 60th vote. Democrats don't even have 51 votes. So there's no margin for error whatsoever. And you have a senator from West Virginia, a state that went overwhelmingly, as we know, for President Trump, who's a Democrat. And of course, Arizona, the political issues there have become obviously pretty well known. Not only is Senator Sinema you know, kind of unpredictable in many ways and kind of
inscrutable, wouldn't you say?
Well, and yeah, just really? Not, you know, the difference between Manchin and Sinema, you know, Manchin will speak to almost any camera that he comes across to tell them the specifics of the things that he wants to, you know, that he likes and doesn't like. And Sinema says absolutely nothing, right? and, you know, trying to read into what that means has made it very difficult for President Biden and the White House to try to thread this needle while trying to make concessions that everyone can get on board with.
Rachel, let me read a question from Corrine. I had the same one. She said, I would like to better understand why Manchin and Sinema seem to think it's bad to negotiate drug prices for Medicare. And there are some other programs that apparently are not going to be part of this framework that are very popular with the American people.
Yeah, it's a huge frustration with most of the party. I will say for Manchin, he's actually on board with that. So right. Sinema is the one very much who killed that pay for. And, you know, this is a promise that Democrats have run on, most Democrats have run on for a really long time. But, you know, to just go back to what Domenico was just saying, you know, you've got to have the vote to do these things. And they don't have the vote. They didn't have that last 50th vote on prescription drugs. Sinema has sort of argued that when it comes to negotiating with drug companies, that, you know, if you allow these negotiations, you know, if drug companies are taking less money, they might be less willing to come up with vaccines like the ones that are saving the country right now. I mean, you can take the argument for what it's worth. You might believe it, you might not. But that's sort of the argument. And I think a lot of people are also looking at the money she gets for, you know, her own campaigns. Right. She obviously gets a lot of funding from the pharmaceutical company to run for her reelection. And, you know, I'm sure people are looking at and scratching their head, too.
Well, yeah, there's also some
reporting.
Yeah,
go ahead, Domenico.
There was also
go ahead.
Reporting that Sinema did reach an agreement with the White House over prescription drug pricing negotiations, but it wasn't included in the framework here. Not entirely sure why that is, if there was some kind of an agreement. You know, this is a framework, and it's something that Biden wanted to be able to take to Europe for these meetings. We'll see if it winds up being there in the end, but there are other senators who, you know, maybe are high on the list of pharmaceutical industry donations, who also have been in the past tentative to support or reluctant to support Medicare prescription drug negotiation power.
Rachel, about a minute before our first break here, but why today? Why is it important for President Biden to take these packages to Europe with him?
Yeah, it's actually, there's two things. Yes, the president's leaving for Europe, a huge worldwide climate summit. He wants to stand on the stage and say, look, the United States is going to live up to a commitment to try to transition to cleaner energy to help with global warming, especially after 4 years of the Trump administration. This would be a huge deal. Other countries, you know, without an American lead might become more frustrated and not do their own part. And so I think the White House really wanted to make this deadline. But there's also this huge race happening in Virginia, a governor's election. And, you know, Democrats thought that if they could get something passed, especially on infrastructure, this other bill that's sort of been hanging out there for a long time, that could be something that turns out voters in Virginia and helps them keep the governor's mansion.
Well, I'll tell you what, we do have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Rachel Bade, co-author of the Politico Playbook. Domenico Montanaro is with us as well, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. And we are talking about, I guess, for lack of a better word, the sausage making that is happening in Congress between Democrats and also involving the House, the Senate, and the White House. The president is apparently speaking as we speak to House Democrats about a framework for his social spending package. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. President Biden is having a jam-packed morning before heading to Europe today with news of a framework on a new package of social spending initiatives, something that has split the Democratic Party. Finding a compromise between progressives and Senators Manchin and Sinema has proved both contentious and elusive. We are talking with NPR's Domenico Montanaro and Politico's Rachel Bade. And again, you can join us any questions questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Domenico, why do progressives want to link this social spending package with the bipartisan infrastructure package?
Well, I think that they want to make sure that they're not left in the dust. You know, just because this infrastructure package passed with a significant bipartisan majority, because of that, they don't want this to languish. You know, if there need to be incentives and deadlines for Congress to actually do anything. I mean, I would argue we probably wouldn't see a framework today if President Biden wasn't leaving for Europe today. Wow. You know, I think that there's that they always need some kind of deadline, some kind of stick, and, you know, obviously a bit of a carrot. And the carrot here, you know, obviously they want to get this big plan through, but they are not going to relent, it seems, to let this infrastructure bill pass without knowing that they're bill is actually going to come up and that their priorities are going to be in that. We're going to be watching today, though, to see if there is a vote, because we know that the White House and Democratic leadership has been pushing for a vote that could come as early as today.
Rachel, I mean, even as we speak, there are discussions going on. I'm assuming people are still writing some of this legislation. Does anyone get a chance to actually read it before they vote on it?
Yes, they'll get a chance to read it before they vote on it. But, you know, the question is, when is that vote going to be? I mean, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Sunday that 90% of the bill was already written. I think that's a little bit overstated. They still got some writing to do. I mean, they have this framework, and we just talked, you know, in the previous segment about how we don't even know if this is the done deal. You know, progressives might try to make changes, but then they have to actually sit down and write this thing. And they do have a lot of it done, but it's going to be a little bit. And so that's where the question of what's going to happen with this big infrastructure vote comes in, because these progressives have been saying they're not going to vote for any infrastructure bill, bipartisan infrastructure bill, until this larger social spending bill is not only drafted, but a lot of them want to actually see it pass the Senate before they vote on this other piece of legislation. So, you know, there's a little bit of a tango going on right now between leadership, which wants this infrastructure bill passed before next week when the Virginia election happens, and progressives who are saying, we're not ready yet, we're not even close. And so with Biden going up to Capitol Hill, you know, he's going to try to convince the progressives to let this infrastructure bill go and to just vote for it right now while they work on the other package. But I don't know that he actually has the sway with lawmakers in the House to actually convince them to do this. So it'll be interesting to watch.
I'm glad you raised that, because I want to toss that to you, Domenico, which is, you know, what kind of muscle, what kind of clout does President Biden have with his own party?
You know, I mean, the party itself knows it needs something to be able to tout for the 2022 midterms, where they're already facing an uphill battle. They have control of the White House. They have control of the Senate. They have control over Congress. And if they appear stuck in the mud and can't negotiate with themselves to be able to get something big passed, what are they able to wave around, you know, as a messaging piece when it comes to electoral politics, not just for the Virginia governor's race, because I'm a little skeptical that people in Virginia are paying that close attention to, you know, oh, well, if a piece of legislation passes, then I'll vote for Terry McAuliffe. But if it doesn't, I'll vote for Glenn Youngkin. I don't think that's
people don't think that way, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite how it's working, you know, as much as people in Virginia are in Northern Virginia are pretty plugged into what's happening. You know, I do think that Democrats all know that they need to pass something to be able to sell for people who are running for re-election next year. Otherwise, what do they have? And I think that it's really difficult, especially considering they already have an uphill battle to retain control of the House next year and are, you know, the underdogs, frankly, to retain control.
Rachel, here's another comment. This one from Jody says, isn't the budget spent over 10 years broken down annually? It's less than half of what we spend on the military. Why are we so afraid of taxing well-off people equally to the poor and middle class? Can you speak to that?
Well, look, I think that Democrats, in terms of how they were going to pay for this, were really pushing to increase taxes on corporations and wealthier individuals. This is something that the party has run on. It's actually a pretty popular message. But again, you know, they ran into roadblocks. Sinema, was against raising these sorts of corporate tax rates and against raising rates for people who make over $400,000 a year. And so they ran into a problem with that. But I want to go back to your question about President Joe Biden and his sway on the Hill, because I thought it's a really interesting dynamic because, you know, the president sort of ran when he was running on the campaign trail. He often talked about his relationships on Capitol Hill and how this would help him be an effective legislator. And, you know, it's interesting, over the past couple of months, I've talked to a lot of Hill Democrats, and one of the things they told me was how surprised they were by his lack of ability to get things done quickly. He does have clearly good relationships with Senate Democrats, but when it comes to the House, you know, he's actually made phone calls and asked people to do things, and those legislators have done the opposite. And so his sway right now with the House, it's really in question. And so that's why today is such an interesting day, because, you know, he's going to ask these progressives to vote for an infrastructure deal and to get behind this framework that he struck with moderate Senate Democrats. But, like, is he going to be able to get it across the finish line? That's a real question right now, and one we're going to be watching very closely.
Well, just picking up on that, Rachel, I mean, he hasn't been a member of Congress for, what, how many years now? So how many people does he, if we're talking about relationships, how many people does he know that he has a relationship with who's in the House, besides Nancy Pelosi and, you know, some of the elders?
It's a really good point. And a lot of the Democrats who are going to be playing hardball, frankly, in the next 48 hours are people who came to Congress within the past, you know, 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years or so. So they're new faces. They're a very different type of Democrat than Joe Biden was for most of his career. They're progressives. They take a little more aggressive approach. And so, you know, they've been promising to play hardball, and it will be interesting to watch how he sort of deals with that.
Well, Domenico, let me pick up on that, because President Biden campaigned on a lot of these issues that the progressives supported: preschool, child tax credit, free community college, expanded Medicare. You know, it's a fairly comprehensive mm-hmm. list there. We have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye to the two of you as you look into your crystal ball today. So what do you expect is going to happen in the next couple of hours?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, if President Biden had a magic wand, he certainly would include all of those things. But, you know, getting Manchin and Sinema to agree to all of these things, I think, has been very frustrating. And the last 3 months have been very difficult for the party and for President Biden, whose approval ratings have suffered. And, you know, short of getting this legislation through and COVID and the economy, you know, improving, he's going to need some boost. The party's going to need some boost as we head into being a year out from next year's midterms.
We're going to leave it there. Domenico Montanaro, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he is senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. Rachel Bade, thank you for joining us in Radio Times as well.
Anytime. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. She is co-author of the Politico Playbook. Well, talk about watching sausage being made. We've all been able to observe the Democrats publicly negotiate, argue over, and disagree about a package of social spending bills. President Biden's Build Back Better plan. Progressive started at something like $6 trillion in spending, and as we have been talking about, met a roadblock from Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who objected to various programs in the plan, the cost, and how to pay for it. The price tag has reportedly been whittled down to something like $1.75 trillion. President Biden is meeting with House Democrats this morning with a framework that he believes will bring his party together. He also wants the House to pass his stalled bipartisan infrastructure bill before he heads off to Europe this afternoon for the G2 and the climate summits. A very busy day in Washington. And joining us now is James Curry. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah. His research focuses on U.S. politics and policymaking, especially in the U.S. Congress. He is co-author with Francis Lee of The Limits of Party Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. And James Curry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. So are we witnessing sausage making being made? The idea of you put all the body parts in the grinder and see what comes out the other end?
We really are. It's almost an unprecedented degree of getting to see this in real time, because so much of it is being covered. So much of it is being talked about in the press. This is the kind of process that goes on behind the scenes on Capitol Hill all the time. But we're having the luxury over the last month or so of being able to watch it up close.
It's not a pretty sight, though.
No, it's not. Nothing about making a law is pretty. I guess that's why we liken it to sausage making. But this is the kind of this is essentially what goes on. This is how a bunch of different legislators elected from different places with different priorities find a way to get to an agreement.
But what you're saying is that maybe in a past Congresses, this is what would be happening behind closed doors. What we're seeing now is it's all happening in front of us.
That's right. And some of that has to do with the fact that with this budget reconciliation package that the Democrats are negotiating, that they only have to negotiate amongst themselves. Because they already pre-committed to doing this on a single party basis. Most lawmaking doesn't work that way, as we all know. Most things involve some level of bipartisan negotiations and bipartisan agreement, which means you don't want to air your dirty laundry as a party ahead of going and having to negotiate with the other side of the aisle. So what you do is you try to do this more quietly. You don't want to communicate that, well, maybe we're kind of shaky on some of these things we're going to ask the other party for. You want to keep that quiet so you have maximum leverage in negotiations. So if Democrats were doing this right now and then had to go negotiate with Republicans, that wouldn't be great because Republicans would already know where all their weaknesses are and where all their divisions are. Without that pressure, there's a lot less reason for Democrats to be quiet about it. And in fact, some Democrats in the House and the Senate now have heightened incentives to be open in public with their thoughts and feelings about what's going on.
Well, I believe in transparency, but I wonder if there aren't risks to, if not individual Democrats, risk to the party, in that if you're paying attention and you look at what's going on, it can be very dispiriting.
Yeah, that's right. This looks like disarray is the word that we've heard a lot lately, because all we're seeing is disagreements and it looks like they can't get it done and it looks like it's going to fall apart. And so the coverage and the narrative that is set around these negotiations, that's set around this, what may become a future law, The narrative there is entirely about all this negativity and all these disagreements and all what isn't in there, and instead of maybe what is in there. And that's not ideal if then you want to turn around and take what you've passed and sell it to voters, because we've just spent several months having all this negative coverage. Instead, it's going to be hard for them to switch gears and now really become unified behind it and talk about it in a positive way. That's not great from a collective standpoint.
Well, I know that Nancy Pelosi and others have blamed the press for, you know, just focusing on the price tag. But I wonder, you know, flipping the script here, whether the Democrats have done a good enough job really selling what's in this package, knowing how popular so many of these provisions are.
Yeah, I think they're going to want to blame the press for that focus. But I think in this case, they have to blame themselves a little bit, because they've been so unclear about what exactly this legislative package is. They've called it different things at different times. And even the monikers they put on it, like this is a social spending package. What does that really mean for a typical voter? And so if you can't get a handle on exactly what it is and what's going to be in it and what isn't, it's easy just to focus on the price tag. And the last thing you ever want when you're trying to communicate to the public about something you're going to pass is for the focus to be on a really large dollar figure that's just kind of astounding in the minds of most people. $3.5 trillion, $6 trillion. People don't want to spend, people want a lot of governmental services, but they don't really want to spend a ton of money on it. And so if they could have been clearer from the start about exactly what they were doing, which, you know, is easier said than done, perhaps there would have been less focus there and more on some of these popular provisions.
But we're talking about really seasoned political people, whether it's the president himself or Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer. I mean, they've been a member of government for, you know, I don't know if you add it all up, maybe 100 years worth of experience.
Yes. But to some degree, they're so focused on what their specific job is right now, which is to figure out how to build legislative support for a specific legislative package in Congress. And these three folks are masters at this. I mean, Pelosi and Biden especially have shown over the years an ability to build coalitional support behind ideas under circumstances where it looked like they would fail. And that's really impressive. But that's a different skill set. This is somewhat of a different skill set than selling it to the public. And if the focus is entirely on what do we have to do legislatively to get this done, sometimes you can lose sight of what should this sound like publicly. And sometimes it's just that takes precedent. Sometimes having to figure out what you have to do legislatively takes precedent, but you're seeing the cost of that now, where the coverage around this law is not necessarily the type of thing that they want to be communicating to voters, especially Democratic voters and independent voters who they need to show up and vote for them in November 2022.
Let me read a comment from Kate. She says, I'm a Democrat and have talked to my Republican friends about this bill. They have no idea what exactly is in it and how it would greatly benefit them. Biden needs to be more direct about exactly what's in it and how it will positively impact everyone, including Republican voters. Picking up on what you were just saying there, James Curry, but I mean, the president does have a bully pulpit. Are you saying he just hasn't
Yes.
used it effectively?
I think he hasn't been able to use it because they hadn't agreed on what was going to be in the bill. I mean, that's, you can't go out and sell like, well, we're going to give these child tax credits when we didn't even know if those child tax credits would appear. You know, and as of this morning, maybe there's a little bit more clarity about what may or may not end in this final package, with the White House putting out sort of its bullet points about things that are included in its current proposal, but it's still not finalized. And that's the problem. Until they have a finalized set of things that this is what is going to be in this bill, it's hard to go out and sell it using a bully pulpit. Now, I assume the president and the White House will turn to that as soon as they have an agreement. But that doesn't erase the several months of press that focused entirely on Democrats in disarray and a price tag and all the things that weren't going to make it into the bill.
Do you agree that this timetable, the president is leaving for Europe for a couple of summits this afternoon? You've got a November election next week. That put pressure on the Democrats to come up with something?
Yes, absolutely. They wanted to get this done. Well, they wanted to get it done a month ago, but now they wanted to get it done before Biden left and before the November elections. It's unclear still if they'll have even like an agreement in principle today or this week at all. But this is also sometimes what legislators do, is they try to set deadlines because it tries to force everyone to come to an agreement and find the finish line, which is what we've seen over and over this year of Democrats setting somewhat arbitrary deadlines to get things done and then blowing through them, just because it helps them ratchet up the pressure in the negotiations to try to get people to agree rather than say, oh, we can wait till next week, we can wait until next month. It'll be interesting to see if they're not in a place where they think they're 90% of the way to an agreement today, what they set is a new sort of arbitrary deadline next time. Is it Thanksgiving? Is it December? Is it something else? Like, what is it going to be?
That is James Curry. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Utah. As I mentioned, his research focuses on U.S. politics and policymaking, and there's a heck of a lot of policy been making happening in Congress over the last couple of months. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We do want to talk about the filibuster and other political issues at stake, and we do want to hear from you as well. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. President Biden is meeting with House Democrats this morning with a framework of spending that he believes will bring his party together. He also wants the House to pass his stalled bipartisan infrastructure bill before he heads off to Europe this afternoon for the G2 and for the climate summit. We're talking with James Curry about how we do legislation in this country. And again, associate professor of political science at the University of Utah. James Curry, I was talking with Domenico Montanaro and Rachel Bade earlier in the hour about the role that both Senators Manchin and Sinema have been playing, how they have been able to really use their clout and I guess perhaps even their minority status within the Democratic Party to wield a lot of power. How do you see what they have been doing?
Well, this is such an unusual moment in that the Democrats have exactly 50 seats, which gives every single one of their senators a tremendous amount of leverage when they're trying to do something on a party line, which they did earlier in the year with the American Rescue Plan, and which they're trying to do now. And There are a number of senators that probably want to take advantage of that, and probably a number of them that are more quietly behind the scenes. But Manchin and Sinema have been able to do it very publicly, in part because it seems their political and electoral incentives align with doing so. This is especially true for Manchin, who relies on getting Republican voters in the state of West Virginia to vote for him in order for him to stay in office. Well, if that's what you need, you have every incentive possible to be very, very public with the things that you disagree with from what your party's plan is, and to talk about it all the time, which is why you see him in front of microphones all the time. Sinema is a little bit harder to read because Arizona is not quite West Virginia, but she's also a lot quieter about it. I think the focus has just really come down on her because of, in part because she was vocal early that she wasn't willing to support a $3.5 trillion plan, and because her objections to the bill seem a lot more quixotic.
So the fact that the Manchin is a Democrat in a largely Republican state helps to explain his unwillingness to go along with this plan.
Yes.
But when you break it down into its component parts, West Virginia is an extraordinarily poor state that people living in that state would actually benefit from the programs that are part of the, you know, whether you call it the, I mean, as you said, so many different names, but the, you know, the social spending programs that would benefit the people in that state a lot.
Yes, but what he needs to strike a balance is that he can then, when this thing does pass, if it does pass, he'll be able to go and talk about those things with voters in his state, including Democrats, independents, and Republicans. But he also has to have it such that there isn't such a revulsion in a general sense for what he supported. And having a big bill that supposedly does all these things on social spending and climate change and whatnot, and had a price tag of $3.5 trillion. That was going to sound bad for Joe Manchin with a lot of West Virginia voters. And they're essentially just going to shut off and say that that's too much, Joe. You're spending way too much money. You're putting us into debt. If he can then instead go back and say, look, I cut this in half. And what I kept in there were all these things that are actually going to help West Virginians, and it's not going to hurt the coal industry, and it's not going to hurt your jobs. That's a way better selling point for him, and a way easier thing for him to go back to. And I mean, Joe Manchin's getting a lot of the focus, but he's not alone. There are other Democrats in the House and the Senate that are not tremendously comfortable with all these things, and that think that some of these provisions that's thought that the original top line dollar amount were going to be political liabilities for them going into 2022. It's just that Manchin has the incentives to be incredibly vocal about it, where the rest of them kind of probably want to be a little bit quieter and are probably very happy that Manchin can take on all the heat on behalf of all of them.
Here's a comment from Margaret. She says, it infuriates me that officials such as Manchin and Sinema are called moderates, moderate compared to whom or what. Labels are misleading. What do you think about that?
I think that's a really good point. This is something that I bring up all the time when people say, oh, well, Manchin is a conservative in the Democratic Party. Well, relative to a lot of his colleagues, yes, he's more conservative, but he's still willing to support almost $2 trillion in spending on social services, healthcare, and climate change. It's hard to call that a moderate, and compared to what we used to mean when we said moderate, he's still willing to spend a lot of money to have the government do a lot of things. Now, he doesn't want to be called a liberal, but in a lot of ways, I think that still makes him something of a liberal. It's just he's not willing to go as far as some of the other folks in his party.
Here's a comment from Edward. We're hearing about the main talking points of the spending package, but what about the rest of the approximately 5,000 pages, things the public doesn't know about? And James Curry, you've written about the fact that oftentimes congressional leaders will push these large bills even before members of Congress have actually read it, but they do it for a reason.
They do it for a reason. Part of it is because it's so hard to get to an agreement on Capitol Hill. I mean, we're seeing this right now. It's hard to get everyone to agree to what they're going to pass, such that once you hit that agreement, you just want to pass it as fast as possible before somebody gets cold feet, before somebody gets nervous and wants to walk it back. So part of that, the re consequence of that is a lot of the times, once you've gotten everyone to agree and say that they're going to vote for it, you just jam it through. And that means that everyone doesn't really get to see the full legislative language in time, that the public certainly doesn't get to see the full legislative language, but even the legislators are not going to wade through every single page of this. They're going to take the word of their leaders that what they agree to is what is reflected in this text and that this is a good idea. But that does make it easier for congressional leaders to keep their members together and pass something that if people had time to scrutinize it yet again and talk about it and think about it and have people raise objections, it may all fall apart again.
Do you think it's getting harder and harder to pass legislation?
Yes and no. I think it's harder to do it in the way that we used to think about how Congress did this, with these relatively slow deliberations, with lots of time to offer amendments and debate things on the floor of the House and Senate, or in committees in the House and the Senate. I think that's a lot harder because our politics are a lot more contentious. There's a lot more incentive for legislators who maybe want to make one party or the other look bad to use those open and deliberative processes to basically do that, rather than try to deliberate towards some sort of outcome, to lob bombs and score political points, basically. I think what they've had to do is they've had to turn to different ways of doing business, which is the type of way we're seeing it right now, which is negotiate frantically up against a deadline and then put that thing together very quickly and pass it. A lot more sort of what we think about as unorthodox approaches to making laws, a lot less regular order. So I think it's very, very different. And I think in some ways that's harder, and it certainly puts a lot more pressure on people in top positions on Capitol Hill, because they have to be engaged on every single major legislative effort at such a frenetic pace. But at the same time, Congress still does pass a lot of pages of law every year. It's just done in such a different manner.
Lots of pages. I mean, lots of words, you're saying.
Lots of words,
I
yeah.
mean, but in terms of policy, you're saying that actually, even though it feels like we're kind of at a log jam, that there actually are policies that get passed. I mean, I guess we
A
can think
lot of
back
policies.
during under the worst of the pandemic. I mean, Congress spent a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, the CARES Act was a truly massive piece of legislation, as was the agreement that they had for COVID relief in December 2020. These were bills that included dozens and dozens and dozens of things that probably would have passed separately as their own separate standalone bills in the past, in the way that Congress used to do business. Same with this Build Back Better social spending plan. It's a bunch of different things that you might have passed as separate bills in the past. But the way Congress has changed how it does business is now it tends to pass these things in these large packages, where they put all these things together in order to try to build a coalition behind some broader vision. Or build a coalition by saying your priorities are in here, as are yours, to a different subsets of members. But that doesn't dilute how much actual policymaking occurs. It just looks like less, because instead of passing 20 different laws, you're passing one, but that one law includes 20 different things.
That is James Curry, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah. His research focuses on U.S. politics and policymaking, and we are talking about both of those things as President Biden meets with Democrats in the House of Representatives. I do want to talk about the filibuster. That's something that you have written about. But let me read a comment from Iban, who says, "We keep talking about Democrats selling the people's agenda. What about the billionaires having already bought cinema and mansion? Good grief, it's the elephant in the room." I mean, the power of lobbyists and the power of money to distort politics, it seems, is such a key and significant issue, James Curry.
Yeah, and it's an important issue, and lobbyists do have a lot of influence, and donors have a lot of influence in their own way. But I think sometimes we still overstate it. I don't think the reason why Kyrsten Sinema is opposed to perhaps a prescription drug plan is because she's receiving donations from that industry. It tends to work the other way, in that she was already a legislator who was skeptical of policies that might have hurt the bottom line of this industry for a variety of reasons. And what happens then is industries now throw money at those advocates that they can find. This is one of the things that we've learned from political science research, is that it tends to work the other way, that donors and industries support legislators who are already sort of allied with them. But then it looks really bad, right? Because it looks like, oh,
Sure,
she's opposing
terrible.
this and she's receiving all this money, but it's probably not as devious as it sounds. Now, that said, this it can be self-reinforcing after that, because now this is Sinema's brand and these are her supporters, and so she probably just doubles down and triples down in this direction. And that goes for all lawmakers from every part of the spectrum. Lobbying potentially makes a bigger difference, because lobbying is about who you talk to and who you're receiving information from and whose perspectives you're hearing as you're thinking about legislation. But the money side of thing probably isn't as devious as it sounds, even if it's still important.
I mean, I would think, though, it makes it harder to negotiate if you're just completely doubled down on a position and you're getting money
Yeah.
for it.
It always makes it hard to negotiate, just if you're committed to a specific position and you've done so publicly or with some important group that's part of your coalition of support in the electorate. This is why negotiating in the open is really, really hard. It's hard to negotiate in front of a camera. It's easier to negotiate behind the scenes where everyone can sort of let down their guard a little bit, where everyone can trust each other, where people can offer things to each other that they would never offer in front of a camera because they would really alienate some sort of key group or key supporter. But yeah, I mean, if Sinema's already taken a hard line in this issue, or Manchin's already taken a hard line in another issue, or if Sanders has taken another hard line in another issue, it's hard to walk it back once you've drawn a line in the sand.
Let me read a comment from Naomi. She says, why is the filibuster treated as a sacrosanct thing? But I do want to talk about the filibuster in light of what's going on in Congress. The Republicans are essentially sitting on the sideline. I'm sure they're enjoying every moment of the Democrats fighting with each other over various, you know, provisions in all of these bills. But if we reformed the filibuster, would that change things?
It would change things a little bit, but I think people overstate or overthink the degree to which filibuster reform would just open the floodgates for legislation. This is something that Francis Lee and I have studied somewhat extensively, where we looked at the things that majority parties wanted to do over the past 30 or so years and looked at when they failed, why did they fail? And we found only about 20% or so of the things that majorities were unable to accomplish failed because they were filibustered by the other party. Now, that's still a good number of things, right? Like, that means there are things that the Democrats could pass right now if there were no filibuster. But there's a much larger set of things that the Democrats still would not be able to pass if you got rid of the filibuster, because what's actually holding them back is a lack of unity within the party. The filibuster often gives a party cover by letting them blame their inability to pass something on the other side when they're not unified anyway. And so something like voting rights reform or raising the minimum wage or immigration reform are things that it is not entirely clear that without the filibuster, the Democrats would be unified to pass. All you have to do is look at what they're doing right now and how they're struggling right now with the social spending bill, where they were able to agree rhetorically that they wanted to pass some big social spending bill. But once it became real and they had to agree on the details, it's been a lot harder to forge agreement, even just within the one party. And this is what you would see happen over and over again without the filibuster, is now the pressure would actually be on. Now they would actually have to figure out what they can agree to specifically. And a lot of the things that it looks like they would pass without the filibuster, they would probably still struggle to pass.
Does the filibuster, though, bring compromise? I mean, and you know, the people who believe in it, that's one of the things I say, that it, you know, it forces us to talk to each other. But we don't even have the quote unquote talking filibuster in Congress, where you have to stand there at the podium for hours on end, you know, reading from Dr. Seuss or even trying to make your case to your colleagues.
It can help, but that's also easy to overstate, because it's just one of many aspects of our broader policymaking structure and policymaking process that are designed intentionally or not to force compromise. In addition to the filibuster, you also have a separation of powers system where more often than not, both parties control one or more parts of it. You just have to look back 1 year where you had Democrats controlling the House and Republicans controlling the Senate and the White House. That forces compromise because you have to get something that a democratically controlled chamber and a Republican controlled chamber would agree to pass. It also just bicameralism in general forces more compromise because there's always going to be difference, as we're seeing right now, between what, say, House Democrats want to support and what Senate Democrats want to support. The filibuster is just one of many things about our system that force legislators to have to compromise and come to the table on in order to actually pass a law. And so when people say that it forces compromise, they're right, but it's not the only thing that forces compromise. It's just one of many things.
We're almost out of time here, but I'm thinking of using the filibuster on the debt ceiling. That seems pretty dangerous.
It is dangerous. I mean, the debt ceiling is such an explosive issue now that, like, either way, it seems like this is really dicey. If you're filibustering a raising of the debt ceiling, like, you're potentially flirting with disaster. If you blow up the filibuster over the debt ceiling, now you're just sort of unleashing all sorts of political strife.
Well, we got to leave it there. James Curry, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah. He mentioned Francis Lee, and he is co-author with Francis Lee of a book titled The Limits of Party Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. The third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you for joining us.